From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After designing skateboard graphics and album covers and directing TV commercials and music videos, Mike Mills has directed his first feature film, Thumbsucker. It's about a 17-year-old who still sucks his thumb. It stars newcomer Lou Pucci and features Vince Vaughn as his debate coach. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mills. Also, we talk with actors Peter Falk and Paul Reiser. The two star as father and son in the new film, The Thing About My Folks. Reiser wrote the screenplay. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews No Direction Home, the new documentary about Bob Dylan, directed by Martin Scorsese. Part one will be shown tonight on public TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film, Thumbsucker, is the first feature directed by my guest, Mike Mills. But you've probably already seen some of his work. He's directed commercials for Nike, Levi's, Volkswagen, and MasterCard. He did the Gap khaki commercial inspired by West Side Story. He's directed music videos for Moby, Yoko Ono, Jack Black, and Air, and has designed album covers for Sonic Youth and the Beastie Boys. His first graphics were designed for his skateboards. He also co-founded the agency The Directors Bureau, whose members include Sophia and Roman Coppola. Mills grew up in a home in which design and fine art were very important. His father directed an art museum in Santa Barbara. His mother sold Vera scarves and was a contractor and architect. Mike Mills' new movie, Thumbsucker, is adapted from a Walter Kern novel of the same name. It stars Lou Pucci as Justin, a troubled 17-year-old high school student who still sucks his thumb out of insecurity. His parents, played by Vincent D'Onofrio and Tilda Swinton, are having midlife crises and disagree about how to handle him. Justin's guidance counselor thinks he has attention deficit hyperactive disorder and suggests medication. In spite of his mother's skepticism, he begins taking the pills, and the transformation is amazing. Here he is with the school's debate coach, played by Vince Vaughn.
How are you doing with the medication?
I read Moby Dick straight through.
That's great. But how do you feel?
I feel like me. I never really did before.
Have you had any other breakthroughs besides the book?
It used to be kind of a hassle to put on underwear in the morning, but now it's kind of easy. Yeah. I actually listened to the words to the Pledge of Allegiance today, and they gave me chills.
I've always felt that you have a real sensitivity when it comes to language. And I know that you're smart. I think that you see a lot more than you take responsibility for. And that kind of perception that you have, that can't be taught by anyone. Rebecca left the debate team. Did she say anything to you about why or?
No.
Well, I need somebody to step up and take her place. I'd like for you to compete with us.
You think I could do it?
Yes, I do.
That's a scene from Mike Mills' new movie, Thumbsucker. Mike Mills, welcome to Fresh Air.
Now,
the main character in Thumbsucker can't stop sucking his thumb, even though he's a teenager on the verge of going into college. Is there anything you relate to about that?
Well, I didn't suck my thumb, but I had all the anxiety. It might have been a good thing if I did suck my thumb. I might have been able to soothe myself a little bit. Beyond that, it's not like I had any of these kind of tics or these sort of mannerisms, but I so much relate to that Justin character, and it became a very personal project for me writing through him.
You know, it's funny, I know that you were also a skateboarder as a teenager, and I would think that as a skateboarder you would have had like your crowd, and you would have been assertive in your own way, and that it would have been different for you than the kid in the film.
Skateboarding now is quite a trendy, it's a great way to get a girlfriend, to be a skateboarder now. Skating, when I was really doing it, when I was competing in it, was really just the biggest bunch of misfits you ever met. And, you know, all the people who couldn't find a place in the rest of the world found it in skateboarding. So we were all, you know, very disenfranchised from any sort of friendliness or any sort of feeling of like, you know, we've made it.
You know, the teenager in your movie is having a lot of troubles, and he's diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactive disorder and is given pills for it, and he decides to take the pills, and it really changes him. I mean, suddenly he's like more focused, he's more successful, he's more aggressive, and in some ways he's more obnoxious. Did you have much experience with pills like that, either taking them or watching friends who did?
Not at that age. You know, I'm 39, and I do feel like a lot of that, you know, the medication of, you know, the introduction of pharmacology into the high school wasn't really there when I was there, or maybe it was, and I just didn't know about it. But it's funny, when we're doing the film, we would go around to high schools looking for locations, and of course I had to go try to find a nurse office that was right for us. And then they say, well, do you want to see where we keep the meds? And I was like, sure. And we opened the door, and there's probably 100 bottles, you know, at each public high school we looked at, and I thought, wow, that's stunning. That's so unlike my world and the world that I knew, and maybe that's part of why I find it interesting, or, you know, it's in the book, but it's definitely something that I find so contemporary.
Now, you have an incredible cast in this, your very first movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You have Keanu Reeves, Vince Vaughn, Vincent D'Onofrio, Tilda Swinton. How did you do it?
You know, you never think, you know, when you finish your script and you start sending out the world, you don't think that those people are going to be in your movie, especially not all of them. And I certainly didn't. And we went out to get financing and went through this year and a half, 2 year long saga of getting told no by just about every film distributor, you know, independent financier in America and most of them in Europe, you know. And so it was a great tragedy. And I thought, oh, my career is just screwed here. I just so messed up, or I'm not, I don't know. I just created this horrible thing that no one wants to finance. And it took a long time, and I really had to go to a lot of those doors myself and get told myself no. And I never had had to deal with that much rejection. Simultaneously, the script's going out to actors and agents, and it's having a totally different life in that world, and it's kind of having its own little brush fire effect where one actor tells another, an agent tells another, and we're getting this accumulation of calls from this crazy amount of people. And and so that was the thing that kind of kept me alive through those years. It was like, man, Tilda Swinton wants to be in this movie. That gave me faith even when everybody else was saying no, you know?
Now, I know that skateboarding has been a big part of your life, both as a skateboarder, but also as an artist. Some of the first work you did related to skateboards. You designed your own skateboards, and you designed logos for, or graphics, I should say, for those skateboards. Mm-hmm. How did you get into skateboarding?
Oh, you know, growing up in Santa Barbara, being a 13-year-old, it's definitely one of your options that's out there. And skateboarding has had many sort of ups and downs, becoming popular, dropping out. And I hit one of them just at the right time where I was 13, and they had all those big skate parks in Southern California, and it was at a point in the history of the culture where there's lots of contests, and it was kind of at a high point. It was fairly organized, and I got in right then. It was a very fortunate time, but it also introduced me to skateboarding is much more than an activity. It's definitely not a sport. It's sort of, you know, it's a subculture, and it's intertwined with punk rock and all the ethos of that. So you immediately have heroes that are all about individuating from mainstream, individuating from expectations, being subversive in some way, always being sort of like a clothing language trickster, you know, never wanting to be defined. And definitely this kind of do-it-yourself attitude. And so, of course, I immediately started, you know, first in a series of horrible punk bands to torture my parents with. And, you know, for a long time, my adolescence, I thought, okay, I'm going to be a professional skateboarder, or, you know, have a skateboard company, or I'm going to be a musician, you know. And I had that dream went on right until the end of high school, where I was like, oh, no, none of those are going to happen. Luckily, I can draw. Okay, I'll get into art school.
So what kind of art did you design for your skateboards when you were a teenager?
Funnily enough, this kind of fits the Justin character. So when I was in high school, I actually made some skateboards in my wood shop, as ridiculous as it is. And I would get lots of blank boards because I knew people in different companies and I could get blank boards. But I was trying to make them all look adult and official and legitimate, you know? They weren't underground or punk in any way. I was actually trying to look sort of corporate or, like, real, you know? And then later on, you know, in a funny way, skating kind of came back in my mid to late 20s when I started doing designs for companies like Stereo, which is a skate company, or Supreme, which is a shop in New York. And that way, sort of, that's, I think, what people associate me with the skate culture. But it really is funny. I'm doing the same thing I did when I was 14, 15 years old.
When you're actually doing it for real and getting paid for it, did you still feel that they should look like official, corporately made skateboards, or did you try to make them more unusual?
Well, funnily, and I really put all this together, my whole way of dealing with punk rock, like as an adult, has been sort of to really look at the cliches of punk rock. Because by the time I'm 30, punk rock is sort of a cliche. CBGBs, Mohawks, whatever you want to call it. Sort of a ripped and torn culture is sort of what you expect. So I often play with doing things very straight, very almost corporate looking as a subversion of what you expect from punk rock. I did a Sonic Youth cover once that was had a picture of their merchandising shirt on the front, and everything about it was very regular and straight, and in a way just trying to flip what you'd expect from them. And same thing I did with Supreme. I did things that were very neat and regular and plain, and it was, again, it just felt wrong for what you would expect from that culture, from that person, from the kid wearing that shirt on the street. It felt wrong, and that's why I liked it. And to me, that is the excitement I got out of punk in the first place, was that wrongness, that incongruity, that sort of banana peel under people's expectations.
My guest is Mike Mills. He directed the new film Thumbsucker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Mills, director of the new film Thumbsucker. He's also directed commercials and videos and has designed graphics for T-shirts and skateboards. You came to art through what you were doing in punk music and in skateboarding. Your father was the director of an art museum in Santa Barbara. He was in the high art world. Did you relate to that world when you were growing up?
Not at all. I hated it. You know, the worst thing to do is have to go to the museum. It was a pain in the ass. And we had to do it all the time and go to these openings. And my father was, you know, my father was sort of like a social king, and he had to talk to everybody. And trying to get my father to leave any party or leave the museum was this endless Kafka-esque, you know, oh, he's never going to leave, you know. So it was a pain. And they were very social, my parents. They had parties, you know, probably every 2 weeks, like 100 people over at the house. And there'd be all these strange, you know, characters that drank too much and were lurking around the house. And my impression of the whole thing was like, these people are just nuts, you know, and this whole thing is nuts. And it's your parents, you know, it's the last thing you're going to identify with. And I used to have to, they would make me take these after school art classes or art clinics because, you know, you're the art museum director's son, you have to support the arts. And luckily, I did have a thing about drawing, but it was largely against my will, participating in all these kind of formal things. And I didn't come around to art. See, you know, all the art I was doing is like, you know, posters for my band, stuff around skating. And, you know, my parents really, they encouraged me, but they didn't really, it wasn't art, you know. And to me, it certainly wasn't their art. And there's this gap between me and them. And when I had that, you know, epiphany at 17, 18, I'm like, oh man, I'm not going to be a professional skateboarder. I suddenly, you know, had to go over. I remember one time asking my dad, okay, Pop, tell me about 20th century art. And then it was this seminal moment in our relationship where I caved in and kind of went over to his side.
And did you like the art world any better when you were in art school?
I did at first, and I, you know, I loved so many people I went to school with, and I was so amazed by them and influenced by them. Cooper Union at the time was a strange place to go to school. It had all like the emotional warmth of like the Port Authority, you know. there's no counselors, there's no dorms. You live at the 92nd Street Y. And my freshman year, someone shot a BB gun at someone else in a critique, and someone else beat someone else up, and you know it's. But, you know, we had a great time. And then one of my biggest teachers, the person that influenced me the most, is a man named Hans Hacke, who's, you know, a conceptual political artist who does lots of work about the institutions of art and the kind of duplicities of it. So, you know, all my teenage rebellion from art all of a sudden got a new father figure who gave me rational, justified opinions of why I should hate art again, you know? And, eventually led me and a lot of my friends were kind of just, you know, this is the 80s art world, Mary Boone Gallery blowing up, people like Julian Schnabel are huge. We're all feeling a little, you know, disillusioned. And a lot of us got into graphics or anything like that because the money was up front. It's obviously crass. and because you're more in the public sphere. And I remember the first time I saw one of my posters wheat pasted on Broadway, I thought, oh, I made it. You know, I am not in the rarefied world of art. I am participating in the world with people, and I'm in the real world, you know?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that you put it that way because, I mean, you're talking about the gallery scene, the painting scene in the 80s as having this, like, really unpleasant business underside, that where money was really important and there was plenty of it. At the same time, you went on to do commercials, and two of your best-known commercials are Gap commercials for khakis, and these were the two, like, West Side Story commercials. One was choreographed to Cool, and the other to the Mambo from the Dance at the Gym. And I mean, they're really catchy commercials, but they're commercials. And I know, like, when I was coming of age, the idea of doing commercials seemed so, well, commercial. You know,
if
you did commercials, you were selling out. Whereas now with commercials, I mean, bands break records in commercials. Bands get discovered in commercials. I mean, commercials are considered, like, much more hip and less strictly just about money. So where did you see yourself fitting in there? What did doing commercials mean to you?
Yeah, well, it's a very complicated road that I don't have resolved or solved, and I think it's one of the more interesting problems of being some sort of, whatever you want to call it, artist-type person who's trying to have a larger audience than the art world provides. And our problem with the art world wasn't that it involved money, but that it hid the money, and it pretended that it was all about sort of an auteur definition of the artist and his creativity and his mind, and that somehow it was above and beyond, you know, human duplicities. And then when you work for a printmaker and you see that, you know, I did, there's a very famous artist I won't name, and I worked for a printmaker, and he came in one morning really hungover, sketched out his wood print, the wood block that he wanted on a napkin, tossed it to me, I cut the whole thing out, you know, blew it up to the size we want, executed the whole thing. We printed it up. Someone from the Brooklyn Museum came by and said, look at the maturity in the handwork and the beauty. and you can clearly see his I'm going to give it away, partly his Scottish roots and da-da-da. And I just was like, oh, my God, this is, you know. And to be honest, it's like my parents again, reminding me of all the things that you don't like about your parents. And so anyways, we just didn't like that it was hiding the money, and that it was hiding, it was, you know, mythologizing things that weren't really true. So that's kind of what got us into wanting just the money to be, you know, the crassness of it to be more exposed, more transparent, more on the surface. And I should say, it's not like what I'm saying is right, you know? This is me at 20, you know what I mean? That was my thinking at 20, 21, and what we were trying to do, and as imperfect as it was, that was our thinking at the time. And then getting into ads, you know, it's a funny thing. Like, what you said before about how ads are now hip and not, you know, sort of perceived as not selling out is, I think, exactly why they're so dangerous, even to filmmakers like myself. And in the ad world, you're treated like a king as a director. The director is really overvalued. And you're kind of led to believe that you are making art, that you're not making commerce. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you didn't go to film school and you don't know how to operate a crew, you haven't done anything, and you have some want to practice, you know, and art school does develop this idea that you should practice your craft, or you need to practice to get a certain level. I mean, me and a lot of people I knew did ads as kind of like going to film school, or as a way to learn, because it's so expensive, you're going to learn on someone else's dime. And I remember one of the first big ads I did was for Nike, and I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what a medium shot and a wide shot and a tight shot was. And I remember, like, 2 days before the shoot, I went into the accountant at the production company, because I knew that he wouldn't tell anybody. And I said, Tom, is a medium shot where it's like from your head to your waist, you know? And so what's a tight shot from your head to your mid chest? And then you can just cut them together and it'll work. And he's proudly telling me, because, you know, the director's asking him a question, and I went and shot it the next day, you know? So I really felt like I was getting one over on the man, you know, and that I was being Robin Hood, and I was taking the money I was earning, and I was paying for my short films and documentaries, and And I was making it so that I could do art in a gallery and not have any need to make any money off of it, you know? And at the same time, I thought I was being somehow subversive by being out in the public and that level being, you know, that hugely exposed, and at the same time having a gallery show about death, you know? And I thought, oh, this is, I'm interesting.
As a teenager, you were into skateboarding. Do you still ever do it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't skate all the time, but I definitely still skate. This is a funny image for you. My skateboard is in the back of my, you know, Volvo station wagon. That's who I am now. That's what I've become. But, you know, there's some parks around that I like to go to and sort of skate in a very retired-like fashion, you know.
What design is on your skateboard?
I got this one. It's kind of totally unlike me. I got it when we're shooting the film. It's from a shop up in Portland, and it's like black with a skull on it. It's completely unlike my taste. But there you go. There you go. You can't control everything.
I bet it looks great in the station wagon.
Yeah.
Mike Mills, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a real honor being on your show.
Mike Mills' first feature film, Thumbsucker, is now out in theaters. You can find links to his short films and his design site at our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Trouble, love, trouble set me free. I have seen your face, and it's too much for me. Trouble, trouble, can't you see? You're eating my heart away, and there's nothing much left of me.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, publisher of Robert's Ridge, a story of courage and sacrifice on Taker Gar Mountain, Afghanistan, by Malcolm McPherson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with actors Peter Falk and Paul Reiser. They play father and son in the new movie, The Thing About My Folks. Reiser wrote the screenplay. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews director Martin Scorsese's new documentary about Bob Dylan, which will be shown tonight and tomorrow night on public TV. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The comic and actor Paul Reiser has teamed up with actor Peter Falk, playing a father and son redefining their relationship in the new film The Thing About My Folks. Reiser wrote the screenplay with Falk in mind. Reiser is best known for his former sitcom Mad About You. Recently, he was featured in the comedy documentary The Aristocrats. Falk has starred in many movies, including three by his late friend John Cassavetes, and he was the star of Columbo. At the beginning of The Thing About My Folks, Paul Reiser is in his Manhattan apartment with his wife, putting the children to bed, when the doorbell rings and Reiser's father, played by Falk, unexpectedly shows up. After denying that anything's wrong, he takes out a note written by his wife, Reiser's mother, saying that she's leaving, but it doesn't say why. With the mystery unsolved, Reiser convinces Falk to take a drive in the country, where Reiser is looking at a home he's thinking of buying. Falk is mystified that his son is considering moving to the country.
And you would really go live on a farm?
It's not a farm, it's a farmhouse. Farmhouse. It's a house with land. It's just, this is, you know, it's something we've been talking about for a while, and because I don't know if we want the girls to grow up in the city. I mean, is that...
The suburbs, I could understand.
Yeah, but I just like the idea of the country. You know, it appeals to me. You know, it's safe, it's quiet. I could do my writing there.
What does that mean, a farm? You'd have, like, what, chickens?
No, not chicken. It's not a farm. It's just, yeah, I mean, you could grow stuff if you want. You could grow tomatoes or corn or something, I'm sure.
In upstate New York?
Yeah, you could, if you, why not?
Well, New Jersey has the fantastic corn.
All right, well, you know what? The point isn't to grow corn.
New York is, I think, maybe too cold for corn.
Forget I said corn. Drop the corn. The point is the house. You go in, it's a house in the country, so it sounds like a nice thing.
Yeah, I understand. Just a quiet place in the country.
Yeah, that's all. It's a house in the country.
Well, you're not going to buy it without looking at it first, though, right?
What are we doing? We're driving to go look at it, right?
Well, you know, you never know.
No, I know. I know.
Paul Reiser, Peter Falk, welcome to Fresh Air. Paul Reiser, you're the screenwriter of the movie and the star with Peter Falk. Why did you want Peter Falk to play the part of the father?
Oh, it never dawned on me that it would be anybody else. It wasn't even a decision. It was actually the truth. I grew up adoring Peter Falk, and I just loved everything I ever saw him do. And I got that from my father. And about 20 years ago, I was back in New Jersey watching my father. I happened to be back, and he happened to have a Peter Falk movie on TV. And watching my father laugh at Peter just gave me that, was the kickoff and the birth of this movie, that something about Peter Falk playing my father, and I don't know. And then it became this.
Peter Falk, did you look at pictures of Paul Reiser's father or anything like that to get what was on his mind?
No, I didn't see any pictures of Paul's father or anything like that. The first thing I got was a script. And I responded to that character very early.
What did you respond to?
I got the feeling that this guy could be wrong a lot. But I liked the fact that he would never admit it.
Paul Reiser, what did you tell Peter Falk you wanted to bring out in the character? What did you tell him about your father?
I didn't tell him anything. I had this had been sitting in my head and in my heart for so many years that when I finally got it out, I was worried about expressing to Peter Falk, the actor, the man, how much this meant to me, how long I've been sitting on it, how much it has to be, Peter, and oh boy, how much you have to read it. I want to get all that intensity out without scaring him. And he called me in the middle of the script. I still have the tape.
I'm on page 54 and I love it. I love this story.
One of the things I really like about the movie is I like the dialogue in the movie, and particularly Peter Falk's dialogue, because it's so much of like that generation and New York.
Yeah.
And I mean, for instance, like you're reading a John Grisham book in it. So you say something like, this guy, one book after another, this guy. Uh-huh. And it's just, so can you talk a little bit about the writing and Peter Falk? I'm sure some of this was just your own
stuff. Yeah, but I mean, the fact that my son decided to be a writer, I mean, everybody has a choice. They should do what they want to do. But on the other hand, I could think of a lot better things for him to be doing than to be a writer. Who ever heard of a writer? I never knew a writer before. So now he's a writer. But in the meantime, and he writes books. In the meantime, when are they going to come out? When are they going to be published?
There are all these extra layers with Peter's acting. Just, you know, and that very line where he goes, he said, you can take a day off. I mean, you're driving in the country with me. Are you sure you can take a day off like this? I said, yeah, I'm fine. I finished the article I had to do. You know, I'm 45 and I'm still saying, no, I finished my homework, Dad. And then the line is, and your book? And I say, no, I'm still working on my book. But on that line, Peter does something with his hand that just waffles back. And your book? And the hand gesture is as if to say, that crazy nonsense you call your work? What the heck is going on? And it's so loaded, and it kills me every time I see it. It's such a negativity to it. My father was very much like Peter, and very jovial, very sweet, and yet the word no was at the beginning of every sentence. Even when he was saying yes, no is what came out. Did you like the restaurant? No, it was very good. Went, what? No, it was very good. I said, well, what is the no applying to? He said, no, I'm saying it's very good.
Talk about hearing your father's voice in your head. Because it's a style of speaking that I think is of a generation.
It is of a generation, and you're right. It is a bit New Yorkish, I suppose. And by the time I sat down to write it, I don't really know that I knew the difference anymore between what I thought was my father's voice and what I know is Peter's voice. So there are certain rhythms I just know. It's just when you write a Peter Falk sentence, it's going to do those little things where it wraps around itself and it repeats. When he bangs the car up and Sam says to him, the father says to him, hey, listen, a new car you can always get. And you look at that on paper and go, that is just the most ass-backward sentence I've ever seen. And you can, the proper thing is, hey, you can always get a new car. But no, he wouldn't say that. He goes, a new car you can always get.
My guests are Peter Falk and Paul Reiser. They star in the new film, The Thing About My Folks. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Paul Reiser and Peter Falk. They play father and son in the new film, The Thing About My Folks, which was written by Reiser. Peter Falk, tell me something about your father.
He worked hard.
In what?
He owned a store, women's and children's, dry goods store. When he was younger, he worked in a grocery store, fruits, sold fruits. But what he wanted more than anything else, what he really wanted was his own store. That's what he wanted. And he finally got one.
So the women and children's store
was
his own store?
The women's and children's store, yeah.
So did you go into that a lot when you were a kid?
Yeah, he used to make me come down there and help out during the Christmas rush.
Did he expect you to go into the business?
He would have liked it, but I think he was wise enough to realize that maybe that wasn't going to happen.
How did he feel about you going into acting?
What he said to me was, when I told him, he said, you mean to tell me you're going to paint your face and make an ass of yourself for the rest of your life?
a little confidence, huh?
Right.
So when your father said that to you, did you feel like he didn't believe in you? Was it a crisis? Or did you just shrug your shoulders and go on?
No, I answered him truthfully. I said yes. And this is why people like him. What he did, he put out his hand and said, good luck. I shook hands, and that was it.
Was it that way with your father, too, Paul?
Yeah, actually, my dad had a business, a health foods wholesaling business.
Oh, health foods?
Health foods wholesaling. That he started it before there was health foods in like the late 30s.
What did he sell in it?
What did he sell? Well, in the beginning, of, you know, vitamins.
Carrot
and
juice.
And carrot juice and salt-free foods and sugar-free foods and stuff like that. But that was before it became, you know, a nationally conscious thing. But so there was always his hope, and actually it was my expectation that I'd go into the business as well. And when I actually left and said, I want to be a comedian, I want to go into this world, he had a hard time understanding it, and it wasn't quite as quick closure as Peter describes it for his family, his father. There was a little adjustment period until what actually sold it to him was funny. When you talk about your father wanted his own shop, my father was trained as a chemical engineer, and he didn't end up using that, and he did this thing, but he just wanted to have his own thing. When I was able to explain to him that for me, going into comedy and acting and writing was the equivalent of what he did. He went off on his own, and he established himself, and I needed to do that. When he understood it in those terms and was able to put sort of a business application to it, like, okay, so these are your beginning years, just like we didn't make a profit for a few years. Okay, I understand that. And and that I was going to pursue it with the same kind of passion and discipline, really, more than passion, was that I w- that it was important to me and that I took it seriously. Then he got it. He said, okay, you know, and he was my biggest fan, and he was a great, great supporter.
Peter Falk, did you ever do like Shakespeare or Ibsen, you know, the kind of classic theater where you're supposed to be speaking a more kind of like standard, almost British type of English? Because I hear such like a rich New York flavor in your voice, and you know, I don't know if there were times
when I first became a professional actor, that was off Broadway, and, mm-hmm. and those were the and we did Purple Dust. That was an O'Casey play, and he was a very rich writer, and he didn't write just naturalistic dialogue. I also did Playboy of the Western World. Oh, wait a minute. And then when I, you know, when you first became an actor, I did one smart thing.
What was that?
I said, I'm going to go to Barnard College. They only have women there. And if they put on a play, they're looking for men. They're looking for male actors. And I went to Barnard College. I wasn't admitted to the college, but how could they put on a play?
Oh, wait. So you went to Barnard just to offer yourself as an actor for their play?
Yes, just to do a play.
And it worked.
And we did a, it was a, I don't recall the name of the play, but it was a well-known melodrama written in verse from the 16th century.
So was your voice and your speech much different than the Peter Falk we know?
Yes, it was hard to talk 16th century verse like this here. This here didn't work there.
But Peter did like creative things. I mean, he was telling a story how you were watching some actors leave a theater, and so you trailed them for like six or seven blocks just to hear how actors talk. Well,
oh,
who was
yeah.
that?
Oh, yeah. I was not a professional actor. But I heard, and I couldn't believe it, I said, this can't be true, that a fellow that I went to high school with had started a winter repertory company in New Haven, Connecticut. I was working in Hartford, and that was about an hour's drive. This is impossible. Somebody that I went to high school with has started? No, can't be. I drive down, and there's the theater. And there's the guy's name. There is the guy's name. And not only his name up there, he's doing a play, Bell, Book, and Candle. Who is in it? Roddy McDowell, Maria Riva, Marlena Dietrich's
daughter.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I can't remember the gentleman that, a middle-aged Hollywood character actor. And I said, wow, this is actually happening. I said, Jimmy Cronin, that was my friend's name. I said, I'll go in the theater. I'm going to ask Jimmy, how did this happen? So I went in, and I heard some voices. And I stopped, and down in the orchestra near the stage, there were three people. And I stopped. I said, holy jamolies, that's Roddy McDowell. That's Estelle Winwood. That was Bell, Book, and Candle. I said, holy jamolies, these are real. I know these. They're stars, these people. I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to listen how they talk. And I went down, and but I wanted to get in a position where I could hear but not be seen. By the time I got where I wanted, they stood up and started to walk out. So I followed them. They turned right. They went into a drugstore, which had booths. And the booth in front of them was taken. The booth in back of them was taken. I sat at the fountain. I was on the Erie. You know what it is? I'm trying to hear from the fountain. But I had to turn my head in profile that one ear could pick up a lot of the conversations, but not a lot.
And what were they talking?
It turned out, as they got up to leave, I could hear clearly what they were saying. And what they were saying was, the way to make money in real estate is to buy land in California. That's what Bob Hope's doing. I was terribly disappointed.
What did you expect they were going to be talking about?
Oh, whatever it was, I knew it was going to be witty. It was going to be sparkling. It was going to have a wit and a life, something that I've never heard before. It wasn't going to be real estate.
So did it make acting seem any more or less accessible to you, having heard this conversation?
It was a setback. And I didn't go forward. It took me another year before I went to Eva LaGallion's class.
No, one more thing. The movie starts, more or less, with your father pouring talcum powder all over his body, and you talk in the voiceover about how much your father loved talcum powder. Where does that come from?
I came from my father loving talcum powder. I'm not bright enough to make up something that hasn't actually happened to me. my sphere of reference is only as wide as my life. And my father used to always come out of a shower and powder himself, and you would see just, you know, cakes and layers of powder all over the floor, like an outtake from Scarface, just all this white powder all over the house. And then it wasn't until, smell, there's something about smells that linger so deep in the memory. And then, of course, when I had kids and I started smelling powder again, oh, man, you start thinking of that memory. So there's something that just sort of runs through this theme line of my life of talcum powder. But again, finding out that a lot of people come over after the screenings and go, hey, you know, that's me. My father always used to powder. And you don't see it. People don't talk about talcum powder, but suddenly it's a rich vein of connection.
Peter Falk, did that do anything for you? You know, throwing baby powder all over your body, did it bring back any memories of?
It reminds you of the first time we shot
it. Are you the powder kind of guy?
I mean, I've been in a lot of movies, done a lot of scenes. I would put that scene among the top favorites of all time for me, watching that scene.
Why?
It's hilarious to me. It's original. It's innovative. I've never seen a scene like it. And you like the guy so much. What a terrific way to begin the movie.
Talk about getting close to somebody. You're right there. He's naked, and you're in there with him.
Peter Falk, Paul Reiser, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Paul Reiser and Peter Falk star in the new movie The Thing About My Folks, which was written by Reiser. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new documentary about Bob Dylan, directed by Martin Scorsese. This is Fresh Air. Martin Scorsese's new biography of Bob Dylan, called No Direction Home, will be shown tonight and tomorrow night on public television. The 3.5-hour documentary is part of PBS's American Master Series. The DVD and the soundtrack have already been released. Our rock critic Ken Tucker considers what this film reveals about Dylan and Scorsese.
Looking for some tears, beginning to work for you like you're 9 pound hammer tears. But I'm there. That's Bob Dylan in concert soon after his 1965 album Highway 61 Revisited had placed him in millions of minds at the very center of American culture. 65 was a pivotal year for Dylan, the one in which his beginnings as a chubby-cheeked, acoustic-strumming ragamuffin had fully given way to a lean, often mean, electric-powered human event. Director Martin Scorsese has culled through hundreds of hours of new, unseen interviews conducted by Dylan's manager and archivist Jeff Rosen, and woven in interviews with everyone from the late but glowing Allen Ginsberg to a very alive and regally embittered Joan Baez. Adding the pop cultural context that is Scorsese's great gift, the filmmaker comes up with a documentary whose greatest achievement is that it doesn't demystify Dylan, it remystifies him. Here's the present-day Dylan, now in his 60s, talking about what appealed to him in his early readings of writers such as Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac.
I fell into that atmosphere of everything Kerouac was saying about the world being completely mad, and the only people for him that were interesting were the mad people, the mad ones, the ones who were, you know, mad to live and mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones who never yawn, all those mad ones. And I felt like I fit right into that bunch.
Soon after this, Dylan, in tight close-up, his cheeks slashed with two long vertical creases, a roué's mustache above his lips, says of his youth in Hibbing, Minnesota, quote, "I didn't feel like I had a past." He notes that listening to people like Hank Williams and Woody Guthrie made him feel restless, homeless, yet thoroughly connected to a certain American tradition, that of the traveler, the rootless man, who, he says, may be a carnival performer one night or a folk singer the next. This is what has always perplexed and sometimes vexed people about Dylan. Pegged as a singer-songwriter, and therefore supposedly someone who is singing his own thoughts and beliefs, it's clear in No Direction Home that Dylan loves show business, the idea of assuming new characters, of speaking in different voices and tongues. You don't laugh when he refers to himself as, quote, a musical expeditionary. Proving the range of that quest, Martin Scorsese brilliantly contrasts the comments that Dylan makes about Woody Guthrie's songs, that they, quote, didn't seem archaic to me, with some slashing rock and roll concert footage with the musicians who would become the band. The two obvious precedents for the Dylan film in Martin Scorsese's canon are Italian American, his 1974 documentary about his family, which featured the sort of intimate conversations that characterized No Direction Home, and Scorsese's 1978 documentary Before the Flood, about Dylan's 1974 so-called comeback tour with the band. But I think that in its constant exploration of how someone creates his own identity with both unfettered imagination and no small amount of ruthlessness, No Direction Home also taps into themes that Scorsese has mulled over in his fictional work, in everything from New York, New York, to The King of Comedy, to The Color of Money. Certainly among the striking things about No Direction Home are the recurring themes of self-invention, authenticity, and ambition. In this film, folkies like Dave Van Ronk and Joan Baez speak in still somewhat bewildered tones of wonderment about the roles that Dylan played, Woody Guthrie wannabe, beat poet with a guitar, and, in what the movie labels as the first film shot of Dylan in New York City, a clownish persona that may well remind you of Charlie Chaplin. Folk musicians and folk fans were confounded by a man who could take their genre's modern legacy of progressive politics and genteel humility and turn it into a platform for pop stardom and an egotism both playful and lethal, depending on whom it was aimed at. Longtime Dylan friend and accompanist Bob Neuwirth is insightful on this subject.
I think he always made exactly the work that he wanted to make at the time he wanted to make it. The audience came to Bob. And that's one of the things that makes him so unique in the history of American music, is the audience came to Bob Dylan.
No Direction Home is a treasure trove of small moments that will connect Dylan's odyssey from Minnesota to Greenwich Village and beyond to your own personal trek through life. Scorsese's camera pans across a picture of a smoky village night spot, and you can see, sitting at a table for a brief flash, the face of the great poet Frank O'Hara, the reason I moved to New York City. No Direction Home stops just before Dylan's 1966 motorcycle crash that kept him in seclusion and offstage for 7 years. But I'm here to tell you, I saw him perform just a few months ago, and the sheer volume, the loudness that so offended the purists 40 years ago, remains exhilarating, rude, and eloquent. Dylan and his current backing group finished Desolation Row, put down their instruments, and came to the front of the stage, standing in a line. Dylan looked to his left at his colleagues, looked to his right, then looked out at the crowd and nodded once. He was saying, in effect, "We may as well have had machine guns in our hands. We blew you away, and you know it." Watching No Direction Home, you'll understand where that ongoing blast-back power comes from.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed No Direction Home, Martin Scorsese's biography of Bob Dylan. The two-part documentary will be shown tonight and tomorrow night on public television. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You walk into the room with the pencil in your hand. See somebody naked. Say, who is that man? You try so hard.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And from Scholastic, presenting the children's book Inkspell by Cornelia Funke, at scholastic.com/Cornelia Funke. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Philip Roth about his early career and his early books like Portnoy's Complaint and Goodbye Columbus. The Library of America has just published the first two volumes of a projected 8-volume collected edition of his works. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.